This episode is kindly sponsored by Armed Angels, a German lifestyle apparel brand that is made to make a difference by making products that are the least harmful to the planet and by enabling people to fight climate change. Their garments are timeless and made with highest respect for people and planet. Like Armed Angels' most known detox denim, no synthetic pesticides, no toxic chlorine during bleaching. In short, perhaps the cleanest innovation your booty has ever worn. Hello everyone, my name is Chloe and welcome to a new season of The Burning Case, a place for critical conversations about our future on this planet and how policy making, but also radical democracy, are essential to make sure that future is not only green, but also fair and inclusive. We'll be chatting about the burning issues of our time, how policies are made, and give you the tools to overhaul the system. Let's get started. Hello everyone and welcome back for a new episode. Last week we explored how the fashion industry had or had not changed that much since the Rana Plaza disaster 10 years ago, when more than 1,000 textile workers died in a factory collapse. What we learned is that despite some positive changes on transparency and safety for workers notably, the industry is still far, far, very far from being sustainable in every sense of the term. But years of pressure are starting to pay off as the EU has started, better late than never, to think about different ways to address the environmental impacts and the working conditions of the industry. In this episode, we'll unpack what's on the table when it comes to sustainable and circular textile, fair working conditions and companies being held accountable for their impacts from an expert and a member of the European Parliament. And finally, we'll hear from a sustainable brand on how they're trying to change things. But before we get started, I'd like to ask you to consider rating the podcast if you like listening to us. You can do this on any podcasting platform you're listening from, and this is really helpful for us to ensure we reach more people and can continue our work. Thank you and enjoy the episode. So to kickstart this episode, we'll focus first on the environmental aspects. And for this, I'm very happy to welcome Valerie Boyton, who is a senior policy officer at the Ellen MacArthur Foundation. Hello, Valerie. It's a sunny morning. How are you? But also, did you drink coffee this morning?
I am actually drinking coffee right now. So I hope that will help.
Cool. And what's your usually coffee order? What do you go for?
Oh, just regular with a bit of milk.
Regular with a bit of milk. Yeah, classic.
I'm sure that's my personality, but it's very
simple. But it's a classic. It's a timeless. You know, it never goes out of fashion. So we'll dive straight in. In our initial episodes, we really talked about the massive environmental impacts that the fashion industry has. It's one of the most polluting. It's one of the most emitting. And yet we have seen so many quote-unquote commitments from the industry, but a lot of them have been debunked as greenwashing. And so this is why sort of 10 years later, but better late than ever, the EU is actually currently putting a lot of policies on the table, discussing a lot of policies around tackling the environmental impacts of the industry. Could you give us an overview of what's currently sort of on the table or in the pipeline at the EU level?
Yeah, so quite interestingly, last year at the end of March, the Commission released an EU textile strategy. So the full name is actually the EU Strategy for Sustainable and Circular Textiles, which already makes you think what the difference is really, but okay. And it's interesting and I find it really quite significant because it's the first time that we have a political document setting out a vision for the fashion industry or even for the textiles industry quite broadly. So everything that has textile fibers in it. So it's the first time that we have that EU level sort of transition agenda laid out. And there is, as the strategy, you know, usually does, there is a vision in there. And in this case, the vision is around 2030. That's the time horizon. And it says that by 2030, textile products placed on the EU market are long-lived and recyclable to a great extent made of recycled fibers, free of hazardous substances and produced in respect of social rights and the environment. And there's a lot more, but I won't read out all of that. But just, I guess that one sentence already tells you a bit around the vision, that it ticks quite a few boxes in terms of ensuring products are actually made to last, they're more durable, and that they are made to be recycled. So we would say they're made to be made again, which is interesting that that vision is there for the first time. We have sort of a political landmark vision. Of course, the question now is, how are we going to get there? What is in place in terms of political and regulatory instruments to make that vision a reality? And the textile strategy lays out quite a few. There's a whole list, if you want, a long list of regulatory initiatives, and I'll just maybe highlight the ones I find quite significant.
Yes, please do.
The one that I find really interesting and I think very powerful, hopefully, potentially, is the work on eco-design. So that relates to a different legislative proposal. That's the ESPR, Eco-Design for Sustainable Products Regulation.
Acronyms, love it.
I know, ESPR, but it's all about eco-design, so changing how products are designed. And this proposal was released on the very same day as the textile strategy last year in 2020, which I guess is also a bit symbolic in a way, again, reinforcing that we do take the textile sector seriously. Hopefully, at least that's what I'm reading, is the commission saying, and we want to tackle the impacts upstream, so at the level of the design. And basically what this regulation will be doing is to draw a line in the sand, right? They will be saying, these are the minimum requirements that your product needs to meet. And if it doesn't meet them, you cannot sell your product on the EU single market. End of story.
And
really interesting. Sorry, go
ahead. Yeah, it's really powerful. But these requirements, are they on the materials used? Is it on the, as you were mentioning, is it on the recyclability of the product or else?
Yeah, so in general, they're twofold. They relate to the performance of products, the environmental performance. And then there's a long list in the proposal relating to things like durability, recyclability, but also ease of disassembly, also climate impact, so the carbon footprint of your product. And then the other side, there is our information requirements. So because we also want to build a system in which we can actually trace our product, ideally from beginning to end of the supply chain, or rather of the life of your product. So products will be equipped with a digital product passport. So there will also be requirements on that level in terms of what information is actually embedded on the product. And that can again relate to how can you take this product apart into its basic components and how can you recycle it, for example, or how can you repair it?
So just to summarize, essentially the goal is that products that will be put on the market, so garment, textiles that will be put on the market at some point, be sold in the EU, will have certain sustainability requirements such as X percent of recycled content or X percent of certified cotton or whatever, and then made in a way that they're easy to repair and probably easy to disassemble and then probably easy to recycle. That's the overarching aim.
That's the goal. And then we'll have a whole stakeholder consultation process, and there will be a lot of research involved because these criteria, of course, need to be evidence-based going forward. That will happen. I think that process will probably start after the summer or even a bit later. So we'll see what the exact requirements will look like. But indeed, on a principle level, that's correct.
So that sounds amazing on paper, right? But what do you think? Do you think it's realistic, actually, that these policies are going to tackle the environmental impact of the fashion industry that we know are super widespread, super big? Do you think they're enough? Like, what, according to you, is the most impactful that thing that the EU could do to actually tackle these impacts?
Yeah, so in a way, I find the textile strategy very promising because it has both upstream policymaking and also downstream policymaking, if you want. Upstream in the sense that there will be a regulatory framework tackling the design of products, so really setting out those minimum criteria that products need to meet, whether it's on durability, recyclability, ease of disassembly, climate footprint, the use of resources, and so on. So that's really interesting. We're going to harmonize, hopefully, those design requirements so that we also have a bit more of a predictability. We know what's put on the market. We know that these products are made to be made again. They're made to be taken apart, to be recycled. That's great. That will actually help the business case for then collecting these products, sorting them, reusing and recycling them because they're made to be used for longer. They're made to be recycled. So that's fantastic. And then that downstream policy making that the textile strategy also does or tries to do, that relates to extended producer responsibility. So the textile strategy announced that the commission will be looking to create common rules. So across the EU, we would see a harmonized approach to extended producer responsibility, which is a mechanism to basically hold businesses accountable for the products to put on the market and ensuring that they also take care of these products when they've been discarded. So investing in an infrastructure for collecting and sorting these products, which in turn helps to improve the economics, really, to build a business case for reuse and recycling. We know that at the moment, it is a very linear model in terms of the materials going into the supply chain. So both the fibers, but also, for example, the fertilizers, the chemicals. There's a lot of materials going in, and the large majority of that is actually finite raw materials. It's virgin stuff. And then we know that, especially in the case of clothing, there is a massive underutilization. We don't really use our clothes to the maximum extent, right? Because they're tied to fashion trends, because people simply get tired of them or whatever. So there, a lot of stuff gets discarded at a moment when reuse is actually still an option. It's not discarded for a functional reason in most cases. So we have an underutilization problem. But we also have a very small level of recycling. We demonstrated in 2017 that less than 1% of textile fibers are actually recycled at the same value, so fibers to fibers. And unfortunately, that still looks to be the case today. So we have low levels of utilization, low levels of recycling, and generally a very inefficient system that hugely relies on virgin inputs and doesn't even use them fully, or sort of, you know, keep them at highest use. And so there is an element here to rethinking the business model and see if we can really keep our products in use for as long as possible and actually build revenue streams out of the repeated use of a product and not just out of that one sort of point of sale. So can we build a business case that really relies on using existing materials and existing products and sort of break the current model in which we're selling something new and then that product sort of disappears, right? So
I have a final question, because, I mean, it all sounds great in theory, right? To reduce the impacts, the environmental impacts of the clothes we consume in Europe. But at the same time, is it realistic to think that this will be enough if we don't tackle the consumption, so the overconsumption of clothing? The numbers are crazy. The number of garments that are produced every year are insane, especially with new brands like Shein and stuff. So is it a bit utopian to think that we can sort of address the environmental impacts without addressing this overconsumption? And if so, what would that look like? Would it be a cap on consumption, on a cap on the number of clothes that a company can sell on the EU market, or a cap on the number of clothes that a consumer can buy every year? I don't know. These are just maybe crazy ideas, but it feels like we're sort of putting a band-aid on a stream of an injury that, you know, keeps flowing into Europe if we don't tackle the overconsumption side.
So I think rather than talking about consumption caps, we need to talk about something that is actually a decade old concept, but we're not really treating it seriously, I think, at the moment in the policy discourse, which is the whole discussion around incorporating externalities, right? So there's a whole range of costs associated with how we consume our products, costs related to pollution, to waste, to the loss of biodiversity, climate change, and so on. And all those costs currently end up accounted for by society, by the public sector, governments, and us taxpayers, really. So I think the question here is one around ensuring that prices are sort of reflective of those full costs, right, of that entire picture. Can we start building a system in which we define what costs are accounted for and by whom? So what externalities are actually priced in? Because we know our economic system, and definitely the fashion industry, it is based on price competition. So those prices need to sort of accurately reflect the impact of these products if we want to make a difference, really, and if we want to transform our economic system and move towards a system in which circular business models make more economic sense than linear ones. And I think there's a whole range of regulations and pieces of legislation that need to be rethought, really, in terms of getting there, getting to this business model transformation. And this is perhaps a bit of a gap in the current policy agenda, or at least in the EU textile strategy, the way it was proposed last year. I think there could have been a bit more of a recognition around how structural and how deeply we need to transform the industry and sort of the core economic model that's underpinning the fashion industry. So there's, Yeah, there's a lot of work around things like taxation. Can we shift taxation maybe away from labor and towards the use of non-renewable resources, towards pollution? That's one element. Think about how trade policy works. Think about subsidies, for example, tariffs, and so on. How can we really rethink all of those policies so that we can help create stronger price signals that really reflect those negative externalities and that really help to shift towards circular business models rather than linear ones? And I think that that's really the place to start. It's a difficult conversation to have politically, definitely, but it is one that needs to happen. And I think, if anything, the European Commission, for example, could actually host these discussions as part of the work on the EU textile strategy. It did lay out that vision for 2030. I think there's an element to sort of hosting discussions and convening stakeholders and sort of really trying to explore how do we get there? Exactly your question, right? What does it take? Is what we have on the table currently, is that enough? Where are the gaps? What is missing? And how can we work together to overcome?
Thank you so much for enlightening us on what's currently on the table when it comes to the environmental side of tackling the impacts of the fashion industry. Stay tuned, everyone. Our second guest is going to share with us what's currently on the table on the human rights and workers' condition. 10 years post Rana Plaza, this is an essential conversation that the EU needs to have. So stay tuned because it's a good one. And thank you so much, Valerie, for coming on the podcast and explaining to us everything that you guys are working on, because clearly it's a groundbreaking moment to tackle the impact of the sector, and you're doing a fantastic job with that.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so to dive into how the EU is addressing the social impacts of the fashion industry, and as we explained in the first episode, there's many, from insufficient living wages to unsafe working conditions and much more. I'm here with Saskia Briquemont, who is a member of the European Parliament from the Greens EFA group and who's been working a lot on fashion and companies' accountability. So first of all, hi Saskia, thanks for being here. How are you doing and what's your coffee order?
Hi. Thank you for inviting me for this very important topic. My coffee order would be a black coffee. All black.
Okay. Straight and simple. Interesting. Let's dive straight in. Can you give us a brief overview of what's currently on the table? So both what's proposed, what's currently discussed, but also maybe prospective policies that focus on workers' rights and better conditions?
Well, we've many different instruments on our table. One of the most important ones when it comes to working conditions and social aspects of our companies' relations and obligations is the due diligence directive. That's one of the big pieces and achievements, I hope, of this mandate. We just voted today in jury committee, and we will vote at the end of May in plenary in the European Parliament. And then we'll enter into negotiation with the governments, which means that we still need to keep the pressure very high in order to have an ambitious piece of legislation at the very end of the negotiating process, which can be a little bit longer. We also have other instruments in preparation, which is the instrument aimed at banning any product tainted with forced labor to enter in the EU markets. We are now starting to negotiate on that instrument in the European Parliament. And my aim, personally, would be to extend it to the worst forms of child labor. To also make sure that our imports are not tainted with child labor. Those are two important elements. And of course, we have other legislations where we need, individually as MEPs and collectively also, to include the social aspects, the working conditions in. For the EU, for instance, we also adopted a directive on minimum wage, which is an achievement somehow, because the social Europe remains the poor parent of our European policies. And nevertheless, for once, we achieved a common approach, which is not the EU-wide minimum wage. Unfortunately, we're not there yet, still pushing for it. But what we obtained is a minimum wage at each member state, which is a big win, because so far, governments have always considered that salaries is their own business and not EU's business. So we're, moving forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned specifically the Due Diligence Directive, which has a terrible acronym, CSDDD. But in a nutshell, it's a regulation that could hold companies accountable for abuses in the supply chain, so both human rights and environmental abuses. If you haven't checked out the episodes that we have on this topic, which are really, really cool, just a little bit of self-promotion. So as you mentioned, it's currently being voted in the European Parliament, and then it will need to be approved, agreed on in trilogues. Can you share a little bit of how this regulation, which would be a gigantic game changer, could affect the fashion industry?
Yes, CS3D for Corporate Sustainable Due Diligence Directive, imposing due diligence obligations to the companies. The initial proposal coming from the European Commission was not that bad, but its scope was too limited to the main biggest companies, which is already important, of course, because the EU as main importer has a huge role to play. And its business, its companies, also companies using a huge, long supply chain until countries like Bangladesh, India, Pakistan, countries providing us or garment, clothes, textiles. They have now, with this directive, obligations to respect social and environmental commitments. Still, the scope is too limited in my view, even in the European Parliament version, because companies under 250 workers will not be covered. But we're moving again towards better regulation, because so far, and we're unfortunately commemorating the 10 years of the collapse of the Rana Plaza, and since 10 years, we see that voluntary measures are not sufficient in order to really make change happen on the ground and in all along the supply chain, and also in the industries in the partner countries. That's why, as a EU biggest importer, we have this role to regulate and to also push the companies with, at the very end of the chain, sanctions if they do not respect this new directive. So companies from 250 workers and with a global turnover over 40 million euros, so quite big companies, but they will also be responsible for their suppliers, which means that SMEs, if they are not directly covered by the same legislation, they will have to be compliant with the commitments under this directive. So the companies will be responsible for who they work with. And this is very important, because it will be a game changer in the EU, but it will also be game changer in the international level and all along the supply chain. And the aim, of course, is to improve the working conditions, safety, health, wages, in the industries such as the Rana Plaza one and the others, and to push our brands. Fast fashion brands are also targeted, of course, with this directive, because the textile sector is considered as a high-risk sector. Yeah. We managed to extend the directive to all sectors. That's an EP victory, because the Commission was targeting certain sectors. We considered that all the companies and all the sectors should be covered. And as I said, biggest companies will be covered, but also all the sectors will. So this is a very important step forward.
So in a nutshell, just to be very concrete, so that means that, for instance, a worker, garment worker working in a factory in Bangladesh who feels unsafe or feels like there's been abuse in the factory or that they're not paid fairly, they, if the person that they're working with, if it's a subsidiary of a European company, then that means that the European company would be responsible for what's happening in that factory, even if it's in Bangladesh, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
This is what they will have to do. Still, the directive is now improving also the access to remedy and the possibility for victims to claim and to file complaints. this will be a long process. And now companies will have, once the directive is being adopted, we still have to negotiate it, right? Then our member states will have 2 years to transpose the directive in their own legislation. And then companies will have a couple of years ahead to adapt. So do not let any brand say we're not ready, all right? They have time, yeah, 28, 29 to comply with this directive, and they should be ready, actually, because this directive is now is starting from the OECD guiding principles, from UN principles that exist for many years now. So
You work a lot on trade and in making sure that trade deals between Europe and other regions or other countries are as sustainable as possible. How could existing or future trade deals, for the matter, be used to ensure that textile workers are actually treated the way they should be treated? Is it a tool that Europe can use, for instance, to put some sort of level of pressure on a foreign country to improve working conditions or, you know, pay a living wage, for instance?
Definitely, definitely. I think trade instruments are one of the international tools that we can use, that we should better use, in order to enforce the commitments. We should apply the same safeguards and the same conditions in our trade agreements that will exist in the due diligence directive, to make them enforceable through roadmaps, for instance, of implementation, and also to get there that we involve civil society actors from the beginning, even before the negotiations for a new trade agreement start, because trade unions, NGOs, local civil society are those actors that know the best what are the challenges on the ground. And those challenges need to be addressed through our trade agreements, economic partnerships, other schemes such as the GSP, General Scheme of Preferences, that we have with several countries. And this is still missing for the moment, because also the EU, the European Commission, most of the involved MEPs in the International Trade Committee considered that we have to develop trades for geostrategic reasons, to get access to resources, to increase the trade flows, and to have more imports-exports, right? That's the aim. To assess the success of a trade agreement is to see whether trade flows increased. It's not to see whether increased trade relations improved working conditions or salaries or do not have an adverse impact on environment, biodiversity and climate. This needs to change. To me, trade is one of the policies that needs to contribute to the SDGs, Sustainable Development Goals. And in that sense, our philosophy of trade policy needs to completely change and to have the aim to contribute to sustainability standards. It's already the case because we reviewed the TSD chapters, Trade and Sustainable Development chapters, which improves the upcoming trade agreements, but not the existing ones. So we need also to include that dimension in existing trade agreements and to improve also the situation in new trade agreements. We have ongoing negotiations with India, for instance, with Indonesia. And those are, of course, strategic countries when it comes to garment sector and working conditions. And so we really have to push at EP level, at civil society level, in order to have a policy coherence included when it comes to trade policy preparation.
I have a final question. You mentioned that, you know, we cannot wait for voluntary measures from individual brands, and there's currently an initiative which is called Good Clothes, Fair Pay that aims to require that all brands and retailers that are selling products in the EU must conduct due diligence on living wages across the global supply chains. How big of an impact would that be if we manage to reach the 1 million signature that is needed for this ECI, so European Citizens Initiative? We'll share the link in the description. But if we manage to reach that 1 million signature, how big of an impact would that be?
Very big. the impact of civil society is important. I can see it on a daily basis in my work in the parliament, where there is no attention, no pressure, no lobbying from civil society side, from citizens, from trade unions, from NGOs. Nothing happens if there's no political willingness to regulate. And I'm pretty sure that if since the collapse of the Rana Plaza, there hadn't been such a mobilization, we wouldn't be there today with this directive, for instance. I really think that it's a long battle, a long struggle, building a coalition, building also allies at a political level that brings us to such legislation. And sometimes I can understand from a citizen's perspective that the process is too slow, too long, but the results of our policies are always the result of political compromises with several political groups that are absolutely not on the same page. Raising awareness to them, because unfortunately we have to do so. We still have to raise awareness about what is happening on the ground in partner countries, what are the working conditions, both in the EU and outside the EU, because we think about Bangladesh, but in countries like Bulgaria, for instance, and others, workers face similar issues. And so an initiative like that one on living wages is key in order to push for other and better regulations.
Fab. So you've heard it, people. Go sign, go take your ID. We'll show it again at the end of the episode. But go take your ID, go sign the ECI for living wages in the textile supply chain. Thank you so much, Saskia. And keep doing the amazing work that you do in the
European Thank you, Chloe. You too. Thank you. Bye.
But actually, some brands are already doing things quite well. And this is why today I'm very, very happy to be able to talk to Katja Krook, who is the Director for Impact and Innovation at Armed Angel, which is a European German-based, actually, sustainable fashion brand. Hi, Katja. How are you doing today?
Hi, Chloe. I'm good. I'm very happy we could talk today.
Yeah, me too. I can't wait to get your insights on the questions. Just before we get started, we have a question for all our guests. What's your coffee order?
It's actually very strong. Black tea is my coffee.
Nice. I hear so many people these days that say, I don't drink coffee, I drink tea. So maybe I should get started. My first
actually,
question
is addictive, so I don't know if it's a healthy change.
No, but I definitely need to lower my coffee consumption. So I think this is just a sign that the universe is telling me to try tea more. My first question is, I've been personally following Armed Angel for a very long time, but maybe can you tell the audience where, like, how did the brand start and sort of where is it now?
Yes, sure. I'll try to keep it short. And also, I'm talking a history when I wasn't there. But in 2007, two young students in Cologne basically had a simple idea of making t-shirts for a good cause. And that's how it started, actually, in the living room of a person who is still leading the company and the CEO of a company and my boss. Yes, and then it's been 16 years, and by now it's 150 employees approximately, and we basically try to, it's not just t-shirt, we try to provide a timeless wardrobe pieces for a more sustainable wardrobe.
Wow, 16 years, that's a long time, and it's super impressive, especially considering, I mean, we'll talk a little bit about it, but the massive challenges that many sustainable fashion brands face today. So congrats on the longevity. What are the main commitments of Armed Angels? Because, you know, a lot of people, I feel, when they see sustainable fashion brands, sometimes there's an emphasis on the human rights or there's an emphasis on the environment, but Armed Angels actually sort of does both, like workers' conditions, but also environmental commitments. So maybe could you explain a little bit what you're trying to achieve?
Yeah, sure. So our impact strategy, or like what are we trying to achieve on an impact side, actually has two main parts. One has to do with our footprint and one we call handprint. So it's footprint and handprint. And footprint is basically the impact we create on people and planet by making products. And this is obviously, you know, our basic homework and our duty to reduce the negative impact we create. So we can talk about this in a second. I just wanted to mention shortly, the second part is about recognizing the role of consumers in fashion and recognizing the role in the journey of consumers also on reducing their footprint and us basically trying to take a role of helping consumers on their journey. And that part is called a handprint. Coming back to the footprint one, obviously, you know, environmental and social commitments are usually long lists and people can read them in our action reports, but I just wanted to mention a couple of things on materials. We have strict minimum requirements on our raw materials. For example, on cotton, we do not source conventional cotton. Organic or recycled is our basic requirement, and then you can do better than that, but we don't go below that. And of course, so on all the other materials, there are also strict requirements. And all of these requirements are also coupled with certifications. And we use certifications that not only certify the origin of the material itself, but also certify each step in supply chain. So for us, it is very important. So we use GOTS, Global Organic Textile Standard, or GRS, Global Recycled Standard certifications, because they are the ones of the that do basically certification of each step for basic social, environmental, and chemical requirements.
And you mentioned certification, which is a super important part. Is that so? How do you avoid green and social washing? Is it at the step where you implement and think about the commitments? Is it because you're always using certification that allows you to ensure that you're not greenwashing or social washing? Is it because you have full transparency on the supply chain? How do you make sure that as a sustainable fashion brand, you don't fall into these traps of sort of promising more than you can deliver?
Yeah, I think there are two parts that I want to mention in reply to this question. Of course, there's basic due diligence we need to do, certifying supply chain, making sure that there is a certification, that there has been an audit, that certain things have been checked and in place, and making sure that we are only, that we ourselves are following our own requirement is, of course, the basis of it. And yes, you know, transparency in supply chain, I cannot say we are having full transparency, because that's a big thing to say. But I think we are very advanced on the journey, if I could say like this. And yes, all of this is required. But I think there's another important part to this, which is being authentic. Even when you have a certification and full supply chain certified, this is not fail-proof, you know? And I think it's super important to just be open about this and honest about this and talk to each other as businesses, but also to consumers about the real situation and supply chain and what it means to have certification and what it means to when it sometimes fails and what can be done and what are we doing. So I think it's also about a type of communication, which also actually brings me to our strategy, which I mentioned, footprint and handprint, right? As it is super important for us that we talk to consumers about their climate journey, not just celebrate, you know, we did this great thing for the climate side or reduce footprint of our products, buy our product, but every product people buy increases their carbon footprint, right? So for us, it's super important that we do not create an impression that by buying our product, you reduce your footprint, because that's not the case. I think that is kind of what drives our anti-greenwashing guidelines, is to make sure that we do not misguide the consumers. You know, can we be specific about what we did and what we achieved, but can we also be clear that everything comes with an impact? Mm. And can we just help consumers to make those choices more consciously?
Yeah, and I think you're right. That makes a lot of sense. And I remember a few years ago seeing a few sustainable fashion brands being authentic like that and saying, we're not 100% perfect, because the industry makes it very difficult to be perfect at this stage, but we're communicating with you where we are on our journey. And I think that's super important. That leads me to my next question. And I mentioned it in the beginning, especially post-COVID, we've seen so many sustainable fashion brands closing because it wasn't profitable enough or the challenges were too high. So according to you, what are the biggest challenges today for a sustainable fashion brand? Because we hear more that we need more sustainable fashion, but at the same time, it's still very difficult for a lot of fashion brands. And in parallel, we see the continuous growth of fast fashion.
Yeah, the challenges in general in our industry are typically, you know, the disrupted supply chains, the growing prices, and everyone just tries to survive within that. But I think if you're a brand which basically keeps the commitment to a higher standards for people and planet, it's just making the same challenge a double challenge. So it's on operational level, but then on strategic level, I think it's just, the main challenge is the overall existing economic system, right? Based on growing consumption and cheapest possible supply chains, because that implies that there's going to be always an interest to abuse environment and humans in supply chain. Basic example, you know, if we are to make a locally made organic wool, no plastic, a wool jacket, right? We can do that, but the prices are of the product then that we need to give to consumers in perception of consumers are too high. We basically do not sell it because there are so many cheap things available, right? And I think that brings me also to, again, a handprint part, because I would love us to talk more about, and in general, media talk more about a more sustainable consumption. Because if you are consuming more consciously, right, if you are just buying one jacket for a few years, you can afford a more expensive jacket. Yeah. If you're buying a jacket every year, this is not the most sustainable jacket, would not be the one you will buy.
And what do you think, if you had to choose one policy that you think would have the biggest impact to make sustainable fashion the norm, what would it be?
Yeah, that's what we discussed. I think there are going to be, we need a couple of policies in reducing footprint, but we also need a policy in a handprint part, you know, if there's anything, I don't want to shift it all to consumers. Yes, I would love to see, let's say, a high quality of garment as legal requirements. So the fabrics and the garments have to pass, you know, number of washes, and it should be high enough that quality is ensured, or living wages is a requirement in supply chain, and maybe starting with tier one and going deeper would be amazing. And I hope that will happen one day. But I would love also us to, again, talk about a consumer journey on this. You know, a climate-friendly wardrobe, as we know it today, should contain no more than 85 pieces, including shoes, right? What can we do, you know, to help people have that more climate-friendly wardrobe? And that is a very tricky question, because if you go to cutting consumption or cutting choice, I mean, as a politician, this is just a dead zone. You don't go there. But somehow, and for brands, it's also a very dangerous topic. You know, it fires back very fast. But somehow we need to tackle this and start talking about this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, but it's sort of so tricky because, as you said, for politicians, it really touches up on the freedom, right, of people and the freedom of choice. And this is a really tricky topic, as we know. But one last question, very quickly, if you had to tell us a few of Armed Angel's long-term goals, what are you trying to achieve as a sustainable fashion brand? What would that be?
Yeah, we actually we have a dream. We call it Net Green. The idea is, we've been talking, you know, about the footprint and handprint. So basically, if our handprint, so if we enable people to make more sustainable choices in their wardrobe and beyond, and the impact of that on their footprint is what we call handprint. So if the handprint we create is bigger than our own footprint, then we basically have a reason to exist for people and planet. So that's what we call Net Green. It's a dream. It's a dream we dream of, and that's our ambition.
And that's a beautiful dream. Thank you so much, Katia, for answering our question, and keep doing the amazing work that you're doing with Armed Angels.
Thank you, Chloe, for your interesting podcast.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Burning Case podcast. We really hope you liked it. If you want to support the podcast, click follow on Spotify or Apple Music. It really helps others find us. Also, if you think other people might find our content interesting, don't hesitate to share on your social media or in the old-fashioned way by talking about us to your friends and community. We hope you'll be back for the next episode, and have a great day.